I'm Madeline Brand. Now let's press play.
We have to take bold action to address our housing shortage, our housing crisis. And that means doing things differently and significant reform. And whenever you propose significant reform, you're going to have political pushback. And that's just the way of the world. And that's okay. This is a hard issue. And if this bill weren't hotly debated, that would be shocking to me. It should be hotly debated because it's an important issue. It's a significant reform. And I welcome that debate.
California State Senator Scott Wiener speaking with KCRW just before his bill was abruptly pulled from a vote yesterday. SB 50 would have forced cities like LA and San Francisco to build more housing along transit lines and in neighborhoods dominated by single-family homes. It was a controversial hot-button bill, as they say. It's not completely dead. It's just been shelved for debate until next year. So, to discuss what happened yesterday, we have KCRW's Anna Scott. She covers housing. Hi.
Hi.
Wow. So, this was a surprise.
It was a surprise, yeah. I don't think a lot of people expected that this bill would just sail through and pass in its current form. It was extremely controversial, but I also don't think people really saw yesterday coming either. It went to the Senate Appropriations Committee, which is kind of this black hole in the legislature where bills sometimes go to die. They simply just don't move forward out of that committee. And you don't always know all of the conversations and machinations that happen behind the scenes when that goes on. And that's what happened here. It was announced that SB 50 would become a two-year bill, which basically just means it's shelved for the rest of this year.
So I guess Scott Wiener was disappointed.
Yes, he was disappointed. He put out a statement saying that exact phrase, but also vowing to try to revive it this year. There are ways that that's possible. It's complicated and unlikely, but he's definitely going to try to bring it back next year if that doesn't work out.
And the head of the Appropriations Committee, he's a Democratic state senator from La Cañada, Flint Ridge. His name is Anthony Portantino.
Right.
And what were the reasons he gave for pulling the bill?
Well, so he probably didn't unilaterally decide to do this. He probably had other conversations, as I was saying before, that we're not going to be completely privy to. But he was definitely an opponent of the bill. He put out a statement saying that he thought it was well-intentioned, but basically too punitive, too punishing towards cities in terms of their compliance, and that he would rather see something that was based around incentives. Hey, if you do this, if you build more housing, we'll give you this great stuff, that kind of thing. His district includes areas like Pasadena, Glendale, most of Burbank. So these are areas that could have been significantly impacted by this, areas with a lot of single family homes, also a lot of jobs. And I imagine that a lot of residents in his district were concerned about it. So that was probably a factor. However, fun fact, Senator Portantino has introduced his own piece of legislation to create a specialized California Housing Crisis Awareness License Plate program. Lest you think that he is not doing anything on this issue. I know.
How is that going to build more housing?
It is
more
funny.
License plates.
I know. It's a fun thing, but the funds from it would go towards a program that helps moderate income people buy houses.
I
so
see.
But it's still funny.
Yeah. Well, anyway, what's not funny is that we're in a housing crisis, right? And this was considered the biggest, most ambitious way of dealing with that. Although, as you say, a lot of people were against it.
Yeah, absolutely. And Governor Newsom has said that he wants to take really bold action on the housing crisis. This was potentially going to be a part of that. It was, I think there were a lot of predictions that this was going to be packaged up with other housing bills, and that's how it might eventually get passed, and that this was going to be a big year for big action on this issue. And now it's kind of questionable, you know, if anything really dramatic is going to happen in 2019 on this enormous problem that we face.
Even though Wiener has said, I'm going to reintroduce this, can he actually do that?
Well, he definitely can in 2020. Whether he can this year is questionable, but at this point,
it seems like he had momentum right now, and mm-hmm. people were talking about it, and he had gathered a bunch of support that perhaps he didn't have last time around, because he did try last year.
Exactly. Yes. He tried last year, got a lot of opposition, made significant changes, brought it back this year as SB 50. So of course, it's completely unpredictable if he brings it back in 2020. He says that he's done polling. His office just put out a press release this morning saying that they've done a survey and that there's a lot of support for this around the state. So, you know, who knows? It could, maybe the third time is the charm, but I don't know. It's you know, certainly it dying twice doesn't portend too well for the third time.
No. And so anything else in the offing besides the license plate thing to address this issue in a substantial way?
Well, there are a number of renter protection bills working their way through the legislature.
But not building housing to the level that this bill had promised.
No, there's nothing like this that's on the table right now. There are housing goals set by the state for cities, and Newsom has started off saying that he's going to be more tough on cities meeting those goals. But those goals are not nearly as ambitious as what was laid out in SB 50.
So we're pretty much back to square one.
Pretty much. In terms of if you're looking at
a legislative
state,
effort. To
a legislative
statewide
effort. To force cities, yeah, to build significant amounts of new housing. We're pretty much back to square one.
KCRW's Anna Scott covers housing for us here at the station. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, acclaimed architect I.M. Pei died yesterday at his home in Manhattan. He was 102 years old. In his very long career, he designed iconic structures around the world. Most well-known, of course, that glass pyramid at the Louvre. Joining us to talk about him is Frances Anderton, host of KCRW's Design and Architecture. Hi, Frances.
Hello, Madeline.
Also joining us is Matt Holzman, host of the KCRW podcast on documentaries called The Document.
Hey, Matt. Hello.
Okay, well, let's begin with you, Frances. Tell us a bit about I.M. Pei's background.
And what an interesting background he had. He was born in China in 1917 to a very affluent family. His father was a banker. His mother was an artist. They left the Chinese mainland. They went to Hong Kong. As I understand it, Pei was intended to go study in the UK. However, he absolutely loved Bing Crosby. Apparently, he would watch Bing Crosby movies while living in Hong Kong. And so he decided America was where he wanted to go. He didn't go to Hollywood. He actually wound up at the Graduate School of Design at Harvard. And there he studied under the great German modernist architect Walter Gropius, the founder of the Bauhaus School. Mm-hmm. That set I.M. Pei on a path that throughout his life he would hew to, which was one of an absolutely committed modernist.
And by that, we're talking, just describe, what is an modernist building that I.M. Pei designed?
Well, of course, there are different manifestations of modernism. You can have curving, you can have Oscar Niemeyer, but at the other end of the spectrum, in the way I.M. Pei expressed it, it was powerful geometric shapes, it was austerity, it was grand spaces, it was extreme high level of craft, very Bauhausian in that sense. Reserved, his buildings were very elegant, but they were also reserved, and to some taste that could tip into cold, perhaps even sort of Spartan. But there was very definitely an immense beauty in the kind of paired back modernism that he espoused.
So he did the Louvre pyramid. We all know that one.
Absolutely, which was hugely controversial at the time, by the way. I don't know if you remember. I mean, that really upset people, but it went on to become a much loved destination. And it's seen as a very clever collision of very old architecture with the Platonic glass solid, you know, or the transparent glass solid, That sounds right. But other buildings, let's talk about the other buildings that he's well known for. Obviously, the East Building of the National Gallery of Art in Washington, these massive blocks mm-hmm. of marble around a triangular courtyard. He did the Bank of China skyscraper in Hong Kong. He did the John F. Kennedy Memorial Library in Boston, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. And he didn't even like rock and roll. But most, I guess, germane to our audience locally is that he famously worked with the super, uber powerful agent Michael Ovitz on the design of the CAA building in Beverly Hills, no longer their home, but back in the 80s. That was a castle for the most powerful agency in Hollywood. And at this point, I'd like to throw to Matt Holtzman, yes, our colleague.
Matt, you're here because you have a lot to say about this building.
Well, I mean, I went there at a very early in my career, and it was an agency, and my expectation was it was like Broadway Danny Rose. And I guess I knew better than that, but when I rolled up to the building, I was so intimidated. First, you drive your car into a spiral staircase, a spiral parking lot going mm-hmm. down, and you start passing the Rolls Royces and the Bentleys, and then you go to the Mercedes and the Porsches, and then there's the Lexuses, and then there was the Volkswagens and Toyotas. So you knew exactly where you were in the pecking order before you even walked into the building.
So you're at the very bottom.
Below the very bottom was where my old Jetta was.
You're in a golf cart.
Absolutely. And then you walk in the building, and it is intended to project power. I mean, it was a building that was so austere and so kind of large of scale. And the craft was incredible. It seemed like it had been built within an inch. Like the specifications must have been very exact, but it was very white and it was very cold. And you walked
very white, as in white marble.
Lots of marble. And lots of glass, aluminum and glass curtain wall. You had a 3-story atrium. The
right.
atrium was this big kind of soaring space,
with
wasn't
one
it?
Plant, as I recall, and one huge Liechtenstein on the wall.
The famous Liechtenstein. But isn't the atrium supposed to open it up and make it more welcoming and bring in light? And
well, it
plants?
Didn't. No, it wasn't plants, as I recall. It was
plant.
And not only that, but I have to say, it was very interesting because the receptionist seemed to reflect the architecture in a way. They seemed austere. They seemed angular. They seemed very minimal in the way that they interacted with you. And there were also walkways where you could see people, you know, the agents and whoever doing their business. And the expectation in a big, important agency was that it would be bustling. Mm-hmm. But it was silent, and you would just see these people in their Hugo Boss suits walking by. And I came from a basement public radio, you know, a basement mm-hmm. a public radio station into this
which,
place.
Which, by the way, we don't live in anymore.
That is true.
We have moved on up.
Very much like
an
I Am
Paid as I. We're in the realm of the Rolls Royces now, no, not but, the golf carts.
Not quite, but we have light and air, definitely.
That's nice.
But it was fascinating because it was almost funny. First, you would be intimidated, and then you would laugh because of the craft that had been used to intimidate you.
But is this Michael Ovitz or is it I Am Paid, or a combination of both?
I think that was a perfect fusion. In fact, our colleague Kim Masters has written, she recollects the when the ground was broken on that building, and she says they had a feng shui ceremony and the setting off of a flight of white birds. I mean, Michael Ovitz was utterly obsessive. I mean, that's what he was famous for.
I'm sure they weren't just birds, though. They were probably hybrid. I mean, they were probably exactly the right birds.
But no, and that building was the perfect projection, I think, of Mike Ovitz. His power at the time, his status was so
he's
kind
moved
of extraordinary.
On, I mean, CAA has moved on.
CAA
to a different...
has moved on to a building actually that is fondly named the Death Star.
That is a massive, intimidating building in Century City, all glass, fronted.
All glass, mm-hmm. yeah, designed actually by Gensler, but
that is not their building. The fact that their original building was a standalone structure, it felt like a standalone structure. It actually was connected to something, but it felt like it was this island of power. The new building being part in Century City, part of a bigger complex, to me does not have the same kind of intimidation factor. Or maybe I'm more confident. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe a little bit of both. And so what is in the old building?
Well, it became Sony Music for a while, and from what I understand, they recently signed a lease with WeWork, which I think is
sign of the times.
Incredibly ironic that people are going to be able to rent a cubicle in the old CAA building and write their scripts or do whatever it is
and
they
bring
do.
Their own plants.
That's
in a completely devolved power structure.
Yeah, fascinating.
Interesting. Okay, well, thank you both so much.
You're
very welcome, Madeline.
Francis Sanderton, Matt Holtzman. I want you to stick around for just a minute or so because we're going to take a little break right now. But we are going to ask you to go online at kcrtlb.com/join and join us.
Yeah,
in
and
our
she
undrive.
Said you. It wasn't me and Francis. It was everybody else.
You can join us too.
Yeah, that's true. Right. I already have.
Matt, you're very, very, very good at pitching. Why don't you do one of your magical pitches?
You've got a few seconds.
This is the only thing I'm going to say. The undrive is going to end in a couple of days. This is really... The first time was a huge experiment. The second time was almost a bigger experiment because it was like, well, it was novel last time. Now is this way of raising money for KCRW going to work? And we're kind of still a little bit bit on tenterhooks to see how the thing ends up, and it's only a couple more days.
I know. And so if it doesn't work, I don't want to, you know, it's be the bearer of bad tidings.
It's going to work because Keisha
could go back
audience,
to the old ways.
No.
Okay, we're not going to do that. We're going to think positively. Right?
KCRW.com/join. If you've never supported the station, or if you're already a sustaining member and you want to give a few bucks more a month, whatever, however, we hope that you'll do it today.
It's a great way to end the week on an update.
Yes.
Right?
It is. Yes, absolutely. Go support the station. Support the voices that you've just heard. Madeline, Matt, just the KCRW is the life of the community, and we rely on you to maintain it. And we thank you. We thank you for your constant support.
Because we can't
of the station.
Do it. Seriously, cannot be here on the air talking about architecture. Cars, plants,
right,
all sorts of stuff.
And we thank you for supporting this building, which actually is a joy to be in.
Yes. Okay. Lots of thanks. And thank you for that little bit more. KCRW.com/join. Coming up, we're going to keep talking about housing, this time public housing. Jordan Downs, the famous public housing development in Watts. It's around 75 years old. There's a new theater production that looks at the history of it. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Jordan Downs housing project in Watts has a long history dating back to the 1940s. Well, now it's undergoing a huge change, $1 billion redevelopment. A new theater project called A Jordan Downs Illumination uses interviews, installations, walking tours, and audience participation to tell the history of Jordan Downs.
When people think about the projects, they think about, you know, the gangs, the riots, the dark times. And maybe people do want to forget some things. But I must tell you that there are some really shiny days here. You know, it's the kind of place where most everybody's your family or your cousin, if not your cousin, then Pookie Duke Stanley's cousin. I mean, it's a tight-knit community. People are family from way back. You know, the kind of place, if you got a porch, and you do, people are going to sit on it, whether you want them to or not.
A Jordan Downs Illumination opens this Friday for a two-week run at the Jordan Downs Rec Center. And joining me now to talk about that is Bruce Lemon. He's Associate Artistic Director for the Cornerstone Theater Company, which is producing this play. And Nancy Keystone is the writer and director of it.
Hi.
Hi.
So, Bruce, just beginning with you, you have a very personal relationship with Jordan Downs, right? I mean, you didn't grow up in it, but you grew up nearby in Watts?
When I was younger, there was not a day that I would walk through the Jordan Downs.
Why?
Because of the reputation.
It was too scary?
The reputation, and I lived on the other side of the neighborhood. And although Watts is only a couple square miles, there are still these invisible barriers that you have to adhere to depending on, like, who you are in the neighborhood. Like, if you're, like, a teenager, you have boundaries that you can't go.
Is it in particular gang territory at all?
Every part of L.A. really is a particular gang territory, to tell you the truth. It's just a matter of whether you're aware of it. And it's the story that's always told whenever someone comes to the neighborhood. They always want to talk about that stuff, but there's more to the neighborhood than just the reputation and the stuff you read about on the news.
Mm-hmm. And Nancy, you did not grow up in the neighborhood, but...
No, I didn't.
So you're developing the play together, right?
Yes, this is a collaborative process that is happening between the Cornerstone Theater Company Ensemble and community members from Watts and Jordan Downs residents. And we've been working on it for about 2 years.
Oh, wow.
It's also a site-specific piece.
And when you say site-specific...
Well, the play is taking place at the Recreation Center, or known to as the people who live there, as just the gym and the Jordan Downs, which is the site of a lot of basketball games and events and giveaways and family-friendly events that have happened in the Jordan Downs, and a lot of good memories.
And Jordan Downs, it began as worker housing, right?
Correct. It was worker housing for the war workers during World War II.
And then when did it become what it is today, a public housing development?
In the 1950s, I think 1955.
And so I guess you're telling a story of an economic shift in Los Angeles, but also a racial shift, right?
Yeah, it's very layered and involves economics, race, politics, expansion, who gets to live where.
The history goes so deep. And I, just being from the neighborhood, I am constantly surprised at just how much happened in that community over time, because your experience of the community as you live there is just what you see every day, not the years of change that have happened within those grounds. It's a totally different community than it was in the 1960s.
Out of the ashes of the 60s, sumptuous flowers of culture bloom in Watts. You walk down the street past burnt out lots, and you hear voices rising in song and poetry. Saxophone, bass, and polyrhythms of drum circles. Through old windows, kids are dancing and painting their hearts out. The paths of Jordan Downs run thick with creative people.
And it's continued to change so drastically over time. And the causes of those changes, you can see like pieces of it when you walk around the community today after learning more about the history of how things have taken place so far there.
I don't know if you can characterize this, because I'm sure many people have different opinions who live there, but in general, what is the sense when it comes to this big, massive redevelopment project that's going on now? Are people generally happy with it? Or are they wary? A mix of both?
You really hear a mix of both when you talk to the community. Some people are really excited about moving into these new apartments that have these amenities that you didn't think you would have before, like heat, you know, or air conditioning.
That's an amenity.
Things like that. Yeah. But at the same time, there's a history of these redevelopments going terribly for the people that are in the community. And it's not easy to go through waiting to find out whether you're going to move across the street to these brand new units, or if you're going to relocate your family to like Apple Valley or Lancaster or something, which is what some of these families are facing.
It's really interesting, the idea, the concept of isolation, and the fact that this community for so long was isolated. I mean, Bruce, you talked about not even wanting to be anywhere near it when you were growing up. And then now there's so much attention being paid to it, multi-billion dollar redevelopment, and the mayor and all sorts of officials saying that this is going to be great and a new dawn for Jordan Downs. And it's being opened up, if you will, quite literally. And I'm wondering if there's kind of an ambivalence amongst people who live there and maybe long-term residents about this idea of no longer being isolated. On the one hand, isolation isn't good in general, but it's also sometimes nice not to have so much attention paid for various reasons, because sometimes that attention cannot be necessarily positive in the end.
There's always been a lot of attention on this community. Like, there are award-winning movies made about what happens in this community. There's a lot being said about it, but it's always like a small percentage of what's going on in the community, because the vast majority of it is families and just people living their lives.
Could I just say also, I do think, and this isn't a real answer, you know, direct answer to that question, but because there will be so many different kinds of people moving in, because it's not only public housing, they're making it, the development will have twice as many units as it has now. So it will be a one-to-one replacement of the 700 public housing units, but then there will be 700 more units that will be the market rate and affordable housing. And so I think that not only the physical, the geography and the architecture is different, but there will be just a, you know, completely different population. And I think that it is just starting to hit people what that will mean. It's just going to be a completely different group of people.
But there have always been different people, right, moving in and out.
There have been different people, I think, you know, of a particular economic level in public housing. But once the economics change in the neighborhood, I think that will feel different.
But isn't that generally considered a good thing, that you want different levels of income living side by side?
So that's, yeah, I think that's the theory, and certainly that would be the hope.
it's supposed to change things over time, like over the course of decades, which is great for the future of the community. But the real question is, what happens to the person there right now who has to figure out what life is going to be tomorrow?
And there's a culture, you know. I mean, Jordan Downs has its own culture. It's a very rich place. And there are a lot of, you know, ways that people interact and socialize that if, I don't know, there's been, I think people are afraid that they're not going to be able to do, you know, live their lives in the way that they've been living their lives.
I guess I'm wondering, you guys came into this and, as you say, Bruce, there's been a lot of attention paid, I guess, in movies and stuff and in the media to Jordan Downs. And I'm wondering how you guys were initially regarded when you came in and said you wanted to do a theater piece. I mean, how did people view you?
When we were spending time with people and learning about stories, we weren't just like saying, give me your story, I'm going to take it and run with it. We were there as fellow stakeholders and fellow like community members who care about sending the right message and telling the right story. And this community is used to people making promises and then disappeared without doing anything that they said they were going to do. And there's no way we were going to do that.
Nancy, do you want to add?
I'm clearly an outsider. And so I did have more, trepidation about people being suspicious of me or about, you know, not being accepted. And I have found nothing but acceptance. And, you know, of course, nobody said anything nasty to me to my face.
Or behind your back. We listen.
But the community has been incredibly warm and embracing and hospitable and gracious. So it's been a very life-giving experience.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nancy Keystone, writer and director of A Jordan Downs Illumination. It opens tonight and runs through May 26th. Bruce Lemon is associate artistic director for the Cornerstone Theater Company. You can find more information about the project at their website at cornerstonetheater.org. Here's another .org for you to remember, kcrw.org. We are asking you quickly, very quickly, to become a member, renew your membership, or upgrade your membership. $32 a month would really help us out. That is, what, about $1 a day? $1 a day of listening worth of KCRW, that is definitely worth it. Probably you're listening, if you are an avid listener, to more than just this show. You're listening to other news shows, or maybe you're listening to the music in the morning or at night or on the weekends. This is a full-service radio station, as you know. There's so many reasons to support it. And the biggest reason of all is we can't do it without you. So we come to you twice a year. And we're doing this UnDrive thing, so we don't want to berate you with, like, endless pitches because that's boring and horrible. So reward us for being not boring and not horrible. KCRW.com/join. Coming up, your Friday film reviews, including the latest John Wick movie. It's number 3.
So I love these movies, and this is the best of all of them. It is exhausting. I was squirming and screaming and, like, grabbing the person sitting next to me. And it was, you got to go see it with people who you already know.
Okay, that's coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday, and that means it's time to talk new movie releases. Christy Lemire is here. She's a film critic for RogerEbert.com and co-host of the podcast Breakfast All Day. Hi there.
Hello. Good to see you.
Good to see you. And Whitney Seibold, also here. He contributes to IGN and co-hosts the podcast Critically Acclaimed. Hi, Whitney.
Good to be back. Thank you.
All right. Well, speaking of back, John Wick is back. John Wick, Chapter 3, the third movie, starring Keanu Reeves.
You have no idea what's coming.
Mr. Wick broke the rules. I trust you understand the repercussions if he survives.
Okay, Is there a plot here, Christy, or is it just a lot of action?
Do you really want plot?
No.
Do you need it?
I just need guns and Keanu.
There's so much more than guns. There are so many gnarly and inventive ways to die in this movie. So this is the third John Wick movie, and it kind of picks up exactly at the end of the second John Wick movie. The countdown has begun, and he's about to be excommunicado from the secret society in which he and all the other criminals with a heart of gold and a honor code seem to dwell. And he's about to be on his own with no protection whatsoever. And then we see what that means for him day in and day out in the rainy streets of this heightened version of New York in which we are all here. It's the best of the three.
Really?
It's intense. It is so fun. It is so gnarly. Chad Stahelski, former stunt coordinator, turned director who did all three of these films. It's the best yet.
Well, that's what you need, a stunt coordinator, right?
These movies exist to have their stunts and their fight scenes and their elegant violence just brought to the highest possible level. People die by knife fight. People die by gunfight, on motorcycle, on horseback. People die by horse. Some very helpful horses.
Someone died in the library.
Yeah.
By books?
A book of Russian folklore is a murder weapon
wow.
in this movie.
Is that some kind of political statement or?
Maybe.
Who's to say?
Wink.
There's not a lot on this mind, and yet it is kind of bogged down by a lot of really complicated mythology. We really get to know the ins and outs of this secret society, maybe a little too much. I think there are a few moments where John Wick is on his desert-bound spirit quest trying to find the ultimate leader behind the high table of super assassins where everything slows down a little bit too much. And when you're getting lost in the mythology, you're just sort of, you start looking at your watch waiting for the action to start again. Luckily, it does.
Oh, God.
And the climax just goes on and on and on, and you're not bored.
Really? You don't get benumbed by all of that?
By the end, you might be a little exhausted. Keanu Reeves is physically exhausted on screen when he's fighting his 1,000th thug in a room of glass. And the audience gets a little exhausted at that point, too.
1,000th thug.
Yeah.
It's a lot. But it's not just violent, and it's not just stylishly violent. Like, I love the specificity to the language and, like, the rigidity of the code by which they all live. And this cast, which is amazing, it's like Lawrence Fishburne and Ian McShane and Halle Berry. Asia Kate Dillon is great in a role here as part of the high tables enforcers. And it's ridiculous, but they sell it and they bring heft to it. So I love these movies, and this is the best of all of them. It is exhausting. I was squirming and screaming and like grabbing the person sitting next to me. And it was, you got to go see it with people who you already know because you're going to want to reach out and grab them.
There will be a fourth, I assume.
Oh.
As long as Keanu Reeves is game, they're going to keep on making these movies.
Can we just talk about the hair for just a second? I mean, there's nothing deep about this movie anyway, so why is his hair so lank and unwashed?
It's raining. It's wet outside a lot. So why bother even trying to style it? He's a pragmatist.
He's also getting into bloody fights. It's wet with sweat and human eviscera all the time.
He doesn't have time for a blowout.
Nope.
Sadly, no. It's the same hairdo as Ted from the Bill and Ted movies.
Yeah.
Just grown up.
It's an ethos.
Okay. I think we've exhausted that topic enough. Moving on, Trial by Fire. This is a movie based on the true story of a man who was executed and he may have been innocent. His house caught on fire. He was accused and convicted of arson. His three daughters were killed in that fire. This movie stars Laura Dern.
I believe the state of Texas is about to kill an innocent man. You failed to challenge witnesses that changed their story.
He had the motive. He had the means. That boy is a monster, and he will die.
His lawyer decided Todd was guilty from the get-go. He failed to find a single scientific expert.
Doesn't mean he's innocent.
Don't let your emotions get the better of you.
Okay, Whitney, you saw this one. I read the article by David Gran on which this is based about Cameron Todd Willingham, the man who was put to death in Texas. I didn't know this part about Laura Dern. Is that part of it? Or
Laura Dern plays the anti-death penalty advocate who helps out the Jack O'Connell character, who has spent several years on death row. He's facing down his final death sentence, and Laura Dern receives appeals in the mail, and she starts fighting to free him and prove his innocence and find some new evidence that might free him. It's all very typically 90s John Grisham storytelling at its finest. This is directed by Edward Zwick, who is very, very much a Hollywood sort of journeyman. He just tells the story very straightforward. He doesn't bring a lot of panache or style to it. Laura Dern is very good, but she's Laura Dern. There's unfortunately not much of an angle to this. It is so straightforward that it becomes kind of plodding by the end. It becomes more about sort of the ins and outs, and everything becomes very predictable. It is based on a true story, but it does fall into those tropes of Hollywood biographies that are sadly all too common. It's not until we get to the very end and they start mentioning Rick Perry by name that we begin to see that
the former governor.
Former governor of Texas, that it is a bit of a political statement, but we have to wait until the very end to get to that point. And it is a 2-hour feature film.
Because he could have commuted the sentence.
He could have commuted the sentence, and this could have been a much stronger anti-death penalty type movie, which is what Edward Zwick is clearly trying to say. He's trying to make a political cause film. And it's just sort of a plain film, unfortunately. And as a result, there's no passion behind it. There's nothing passionate I can really say about it.
Well, the article, which you can read in The New Yorker, is fantastic.
Oh, indeed.
By David Grand. Great writer. Okay. Moving on to Photograph. This is an Indian drama about a struggling street photographer who falls in love with one of his subjects, a beautiful young woman. No clip because it's not in English.
Right. So it's about a guy who's from a rural village living in Mumbai, trying to make it, taking pictures of tourists and visitors. And one day he takes a picture of a young woman who is beautiful and very shy. And he becomes transfixed by her. At the same time, he has this mounting pressure from his grandma back home in the village to get married, to find a wife. And everybody he knows in town, they all know the grandma too. And they know that the grandma is pressuring him to settle down and get married. She, this young woman, happens to be an accounting student. She doesn't want an arranged marriage. She wants to have her own life and her own career. But he gets the idea to pretend that she is the fiance to appease the grandma when grandma comes to town. It is the stuff of screwball comedy, mistaken identity and pretending to be someone that you're not. But it's so slow and so understated almost to a fault that the moments that would be wacky and heightened in an ordinary version of this film, specifically an American English language version of this film, are almost too understated, almost too subdued. And there are moments that you want the payoff of something to happen and you don't get it.
I actually was counting down. The first time the two lead characters touch each other physically is 84 minutes into the film.
Which, I don't know, maybe that's nice, a nice refreshing break from
just sort of the usual cliches.
Like maybe there's some tension there. It's like a Jane Austen novel.
There's a difference between tension and dullness. Yeah, I too was waiting for some sort of big payoff, some sort of big emotional breakthrough, and it's just not there. And there's a lot to be said for that wonderful romantic moment where you've just met, and the first time your hands touch, your bodies just electrify. But this film isn't really interested in building that tension. It's just sort of in keeping the two lead characters in close proximity, hoping that the audience will feel tension. And yeah, like you said, it is so unbelievably understated that it's almost not stated.
But it's sweet.
So Downton Abbey it is not.
No. It's charming, it's sweet, you know, but I felt a little disappointed in the end.
Yeah.
Okay. Moving on to another romance. The Sun is also a star based on the YA novel.
I don't believe in love.
So no magic, no fate, no meant to be. What if I told you I could get you to fall in love with me? Just give me a day.
An hour.
What are your key ingredients to falling in love? My ingredients are friendship, chemistry, the X factor.
What's the X factor?
Don't worry, we've got it.
Okay, so time's a ticking and they have a day to roam Manhattan and fall in love?
Yes, you have impossibly beautiful people wandering through this gauzy, dreamy incarnation of New York City. So Yara Shahidi plays a young woman who is the daughter of Jamaican immigrants. Charles Melton is the son of Korean immigrants. So there is a culture clash element to this as well. Each of them has expectations on them based on their families and where they come from. And they both want to make their own way in America on their own terms and their own own expectations. He insists that he can make her fall in love with him. They meet cute on the street and they spend the whole day walking and talking. But there is a ticking clock element because her family is going to be deported back to Jamaica the next day. He does not know that. He's just has this arbitrary give me a day deadline. So it does kind of feel like a Richard Linklater before movie. Mm-hmm. You know, they're walking and talking. It's got to end by a certain point in time in the day. They are lovely. They're impossibly beautiful. And the city looks lovely. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, it's the stuff of YA fantasy. Just give yourself over to it. There's a lovely, perfect spot for this film to end. And it does not end there. There's a perfect Aww. Ending spot. And then it jumps ahead 5 years later. And I'm like, no, you oh, have no. the chance to do something daring and different. And then Lakota like ruins everything.
Because you know what happens what 5 years later.
Yeah.
You know.
I know. I kind of liked how it was going to end prior to that. So if you, maybe walk out right then. Leave the theater then and be satisfied.
We can edit films ourselves, right?
If only.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, so tell me about these two actors. Who are they?
Yara Shahidi is on Blackish, and Charles Melton is on Riverdale. He's Reggie on Riverdale. And they both make this leap from television to film really nicely. They both have, you know, a great screen presence. They are lovely individually. They're lovely together. They are poreless and beautiful. The first time you see him, he has his shirt off, so you get full abs.
Okay.
It knows what it's doing for its target audience. I will say that.
It does. It does.
I love abs.
I love, I love ab fab.
I love ab fab as well.
This is not that, though. This is not quite so sparkling, but it's nice. Mm. It's sweet.
So it's not a Woody Allen movie.
Some of the dialogue is really painfully on the nose. No, it's not a Woody Allen movie, but they have a decent chemistry with each other.
Okay.
It's lovely.
Lovely. All right. Well, lovely to have you both.
You too.
Thanks for having us.
Christy Lemire, film critic for RogerEbert.com and co-host of the podcast Breakfast All Day. Whitney Seibold contributes to IGN and co-hosts the podcast Critically Acclaimed.
Thank you.
Thank you. And joining us now is Warren Olmey, host of To the Point, the podcast. Hi there.
Hello.
What's on your show this week?
Well, we got to talk about the separation of powers argument between the president and the Congress. Is he above the law? Does Congress have the right of oversight and the opportunity and the obligation even to investigate all the things that have come up because of the Mueller report and other things as well? It's a really interesting argument, and of course it goes all the way back to the Constitution, and you talk about it in various ways in terms of constitutional law and history and, of course, the politics, and it's all about how politics and our system intermix and how it works.
Right, because it was always about politics.
That's it. It always is, always will be.
Yeah, okay, great. Warren Olmey, To the Point, the podcast. Download it wherever you get your podcasts. Here, KCRW.com, for example. Thank you so much.
A lot of fun.
Coming up, sports. The Sklar brothers are here. They'll talk about those other brothers, you know, the Currys, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
Okay, you know what that means. Time to talk sports with the Sklar brothers.
Hi, Madeline.
Hi,
hello.
You guys.
Lots of great
Sklar.
Stuff.
Okay, we're going to talk about another pair of brothers, the Currys.
The Currys are amazing.
Curry v. Curry.
Seth and Steph. Steph and Seth. We were talking before we got on the air. Very like for their parents, high degree of difficulty.
How
if you're trying to yell at one
yes.
of them, or if you're in another room, I yell at my kids all the time from far away. Who do they know who they're yelling at?
Seth,
like, and then Steph comes in.
No,
I
Seth.
Wanted Seth.
Steph comes in.
So Steph Curry is the best. I mean, he's been the league MVP.
He's the
been
Golden State Warriors.
Golden State Warriors. This guy has won. He's championship hardware. Seth. And Steph, by the way, went to
a small college,
and he had a great run in the NCAA tournament as a small school, mid-major.
He kind of came out of nowhere. Seth went to Duke.
Duke is like the best college.
But how come
school.
We haven't heard of Seth until now?
Seth has been a good NBA player.
But he's in the shadow of his older brother, 3 years older. Steph is 31. Seth is 28. And
Seth finally is making a name for himself in Portland. Now, the Portland Trailblazers last night played against the Golden State Warriors and almost beat them. I mean, Seth Curry hit a shot that
I thought was going to seal the game. He had a three-point shot, and he hit several threes. Seth Curry played great defense on Steph, like stole the ball
really?
A couple times. It was
that is some serious sibling
brother
rivalry.
On brother action.
And to what they kept
serious
on cutting to shots of the
Cain
parents.
Cain and Abel situation.
Oh,
yes,
Cain and Abel, Sklar and Sklar.
I
yes.
know they're all the same.
Cain and Abel, and sometimes they refer to a basketball as the Rock. So you're going to take the Rock upside someone's head. It could happen, but it was. I literally thought Seth Curry is going to step out and really have
the game and help Portland win on the road, you know, which is hard to do. But of course, Golden State, they're missing Kevin Durant, who's injured. Now they're saying he probably won't be back in this series.
For the next three games. And Kevin Durant is the best player on the Golden State Warriors, even though they have Klay Thompson, even though they have Steph Curry mm-hmm. and Draymond Green. Kevin Durant is probably the best player on the planet right now.
For a non-sports fans, without Kevin Durant on the Warriors, we can make
we'll make an Avengers analogy.
Endgame. It's like after Hulk put the glove on and then his arm was depleted. So he's like a one-arm Hulk. That's what the Golden State Warriors. They're still the Hulk.
They can still Hulk you, but I mean,
yeah.
you are not both-armed Hulk. And so what was interesting is that the Golden State Warriors without Kevin Durant are they're a beatable team. However, they're still amazing. They're still probably the best team in the West. So what you saw was a game that went down to the wire, and Portland almost pulled it out on the road, but they now go back to Portland with being down 2-0, and it kind of looks like
certainly if Golden State pulls one out in Portland.
It's I want to know what happens when this is all over and they have to go home to mom and dad.
Well, mom and dad were in the crowd, and it's so funny because they were wearing the jerseys where the front of the jersey is Portland, one of them, and then the back is Golden State, and then the other one the mom is wearing, the front is Golden State, and the back is Portland, and they're just rooting for their kids. And actually, Doris Burke, who is one of the best announcers in all covering all the NBA, she was interviewing Steph after the game and said, "What are your parents going through right now, and how difficult is this for them?" And Steph said, "It's not difficult at all. They're so happy. They're blessed that their two sons are playing at the highest level." So I think they really are appreciating it right now. I think, to me, you thought Steph was going to win. You knew Steph was going to win. We kind of in our hearts believe it. But to see Seth playing well, it's a victory for him on some moral
which
level.
One of you is Steph and which is Seth?
I'm Steph.
I think we're both Steph. We're probably both Seth. We probably both think we're Steph, but we're
both Kevin Durant and that we're always injured.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about the abysmal Lakers.
Yeah. The Lakers have a new coach.
So they have a new coach. That's good news.
It's great.
Frank Vogel. Who is he?
Frank Vogel coached in the East.
Coached the Indiana Pacers. Led them to an Eastern Conference final when no one thought that team could get there. So he is a good coach. He is a well-respected coach. The question is, will LeBron listen to him? Are we going to be in a TV timeout next season?
Well, the reason that Jay is bringing it up is because Frank Vogel took a 3-year contract that two other coaches wouldn't take because he was also forced to have Jason Kidd, former NBA coach of the Milwaukee Bucks, somewhat disgraced because of weird issues in his past with domestic violence, weird issues with drunk driving. So he's had a bit of a checkered past, and I don't think the Lakers could have named Jason Kidd as their next coach. So they said, Frank Vogel, you be the coach. You've got to take Jason Kidd as your assistant.
And a lot of that people think is coming from LeBron.
Grooming Jason Kidd to be eventually in a couple of years the next coach.
And so you think LeBron's sort of whispering in their ears and saying,
well, LeBron played with Jason Kidd on the Team USA years ago, and so they're buddies, they're friends, and I know he listens to him. What happens in a TV timeout? The camera, Frank Vogel has assembled the team and he's drawing up the play that they're supposed to do, and then there's LeBron off to the side just chatting with Jason Kidd about what he's going to do.
It's going to happen.
All right, let's move on. Final story, Tiger Woods. It's either up or down with this guy, right?
I mean, he won the Masters.
He won the Masters. However, he's not doing so well in the PGA. And he's being sued.
Do you think maybe one has something to do with
it?
How do you play golf when you've got a giant, like, crazy lawsuit coming at you?
Right.
I don't know if I'd
play
that well.
So this bartender at his restaurant called The Woods.
So bartender in Tiger Woods restaurant in Jupiter, Florida, I guess after hours, or was overserved, or
so over three times the legal limit.
Right. And he was involved in a fatal car accident where he died, and his parents are suing Tiger Woods as, you know, being sort of the owner of the restaurant that was quote unquote responsible for putting this guy in this situation that he was.
Even though he drank himself.
Yes, that's right.
I mean,
he did it himself.
I mean, either way, that's part of, you know, owning a business. Mm-hmm. I mean, that those are
the liability. Yeah.
The liability you have when you take on that. That's an extra, you know, we also have seen how Tiger Woods has dealt with a lot of extracurricular activity in his life.
When the extramarital affairs and the problems with his wife became very public, he did not handle that very well. And over the course of a decade, just...
Also involved in substance abuse.
Substance abuse for himself as well. And then the breakdown of his body. So he made it all the way back and won the Masters this year, which was incredible. Probably one of the greatest overall career comebacks in all of sports, to now be dealing with this. And it may be affecting him. He at the PGA,
he had a very up and down round one. At the start of round one,
he was +2 and the leader was -7. So he's 9 strokes off the lead. And the question is, can he come back while the rest of the field stays where it is? Now, typically, U.S. Opens and PGA tournaments are hard to score at because they're put on golf courses that are very difficult.
This is the Bethpage Black course, which is a very hard course to score on. Brooks Koepka, who's the leader right now, he's -7.
He shot a record 63 in the first round, which is just...
Course record.
Blew everyone's mind. So this is not a course where people go low a lot of the time. So Tiger Woods has a lot of ground to make up. And he has to make sure that everybody stays the same in order.
If Tiger Woods can have a good second round and be 3 or 4 under par, make the cut and go into Saturday with a little momentum, he could be on the leaderboard by Sunday. But a lot has to happen. And the questions are these things that are happening off the course going to continue to affect him into the weekend?
And he got to go to the White House.
He did get to go to the White House and received a Medal of Honor of some sort. Mm-hmm. Which, again, seems somewhat weird for winning the Masters and coming back. I think Trump probably just wants to play golf with him and be friends with him and play golf with him. He did go to the White House. I'm sure he was served fast food because that's just what you do there.
That's what you eat there.
Right? So I don't know what type of meal he's used to getting, but I'm sure enjoy that Arby's, my man.
Are you sure it's Arby's?
I don't know if it's
Arby's. Might be a step up.
Is Arby's step up? Maybe. I don't know.
I think it's a Big Mac. He's a Big Mac kind of president.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Sklar Brothers, Randy and Jason. You can check out their sports podcast, View from the Cheap Seats. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, man.
Sklar Brothers, just one reason why you listen to KCRW. They're so great. They're so fun. And you learn a little bit. That's what KCRW is. It's so much fun and you learn something. So why don't you support it at kcrw.com/join. This is our last Friday. This is where we're winding up our UnDrive pledge drive. We're just going to end it all on Monday. Not it all, but... this pledge drive, and we want to do it on a high note. We want you guys, you in particular, to be a part of the station. So kcrw.com/join. That's how you do it. Lots of great raffles or lots of great thank you gifts there. Lots of great promotions. Lots of great sweepstakes for you to be a part of. We've got the Austin City Limit sweepstakes. We have the James Blake performance at our new headquarters right here. Brand new, squeaky clean headquarters. Lots for you to be a part of. Of course, KCRW, the community, that's the biggest reason for you to join. It's just fantastic. And you really keep us alive. We can't do it without you. And I'm not just saying that. We do not survive without the public. And you are the public. So anything, any amount is great. We're looking for $32 a month if you can swing it. KCRW.com/join. I want to thank everyone who's already done so. You guys are amazing. And I love you. KCRW.com/join. That's it for us today. Don't forget to subscribe as well to our podcast. You can get that for free on iTunes. Our producers are Michelle Aloy, Yael Evan Orr, Alex Trigvedotter, Rosalie Atkinson, and Adriana Cargill. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Amy Ta, our digital producer. Mike Stark engineered this week. Mario Saavedra is our technical director. He also engineered today. And again, start the weekend right. Become a sustaining member at kcrw.com/join. Have a great weekend. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.